This is Alaska's future. I see no other way that we can continue to pay the state's bills into the future without this pipeline.
The House votes unanimously to approve the TransCanada buyout. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, November 4th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new foster care program aimed at keeping children in their villages.
The child would be able to stay closer to their culture, stay closer to their relatives, to their parents.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The Alaska Marine Conservation Council promotes local fishermen and seafood caught by Alaskans for Alaskans. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
With a unanimous vote in the House earlier today, the Alaska legislature has approved Governor Bill Walker's bill ending the state's partnership with TransCanada and taking a larger role in the project to build a natural gas line from the North Slope. The Alaska LNG project will now become a four-way partnership between the state and the three major North Slope producers, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips. APRN's Rachel Waldholtz is in Juneau covering the legislative session. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Lori.
Rachel, what was the reaction when the House voted today?
Well, when the board lit up and showed all 39 House members were listed in green, which means that every single member had voted yes, there was definitely a bit of a stir. So that's 22 Republicans and 16 Democrats and the lone independent all voting yes on this bill. The only person who didn't vote was Representative Louise Stutes of Kodiak, who was excused today. So that's a stronger vote even than the one yesterday in the Senate, which passed the measure 16-3. And it's a big win for Governor Walker. He said from the start that the state needs a bigger say in the gas line project, and now it will have that.
So, Rachel, what are the stakes?
Well, by the time they took this vote, a lot of lawmakers saw this as a live or die vote for the gas line project itself. I think for a lot of Republicans especially, they aren't necessarily happy with the Walker administration or with the way it's handling the gas line, but they felt they had to approve this request to support the project and to keep it moving forward. Representative Mark Newman, he's a Republican from Big Lake, and he's co-chair of the House Finance Committee, which worked on the bill. And he was actually very skeptical of administration officials during the hearings themselves. But this is what he said right before the vote.
This is Alaska's future. I see no other way that we can continue to pay the state's bills into the future without this pipeline. We are a resource development state. It's what we do.
You know, but other lawmakers saw it as a much simpler issue. Representative Les Guerra, he's an Anchorage Democrat, and he said it's just a financial decision. This project will cost less without TransCanada as a partner, and this is what he said on the floor.
Mr. Speaker, we could all engage in a lot of flowery speeches about the importance of a gas line, and it is important to the state's future. And I suspect we'll hear a lot of that, and some of that will be justified. But that's not what this bill is about. This bill is about saving the state money. It's about saving the public money. And it's about making more money for the state if this project moves forward.
Rachel, remind us what this is all about. How does this mean the state gets a bigger share of the project?
Yeah, well, the Alaska LNG project includes three parts. There's the gas treatment plant on the North Slope, there's the pipeline down to Cook Inlet, and then there's a liquefaction plant in Nikiski. And right now, TransCanada controls the state's share of the gas treatment plant and the pipeline. So by ending the partnership, the state will have a full 25% stake in all three parts of the project and a full 25% vote in the project itself.
Lawmakers started the session much more skeptical of the governor's proposal, even a little antagonistic. What changed?
Well, I think lawmakers thought the administration made a pretty strong financial case that it would be more expensive to keep TransCanada in as a partner than to end the partnership now. So I think that was really key. But also, it became clear that TransCanada itself wanted out of the partnership. Representatives from the company told lawmakers that once it was clear the Walker administration wanted them out of the project, that they just couldn't be as effective and it wasn't worth it for them to stay in. And it seemed likely that if the legislature rejected this bill, TransCanada would walk away anyway. So I think a lot of lawmakers didn't feel like they had much of a choice. And I think that they agreed with the administration in the end that the state just needs more control of this potential gas line project, which could be huge.
All right. Well, thank you so much for covering it for us and being there as lawmakers dealt with this big issue with TransCanada.
Yeah, thanks so much, Lori.
That was APRN's energy reporter, Rachel Waldholtz, reporting from Juneau. A private plane crashed near Eldred Rock, south of Haines, this afternoon, carrying three passengers and a pilot. Lieutenant Greg Isbell says it was reported by Alaska Seaplanes to the U.S. Coast Guard.
District 17 Command Center received a phone call from Alaska Seaplane saying they had overheard a mayday and that the aircraft was a Cessna. They were going to attempt to land on the east side of Lynn Canal and that they were in vicinity of Eldred Rock.
Isbell said three people were met by emergency responders at the Juneau Airport. One person was taken to Bartlett Regional Hospital. The Federal Bureau of Investigation has wrapped up an assessment of what to do if a nuclear bomb is found at the port of Anchorage.
We started on Monday morning, was more kind of a deployment of forces and then really identifying and rendering safe the situation. That took place on Tuesday.
Stacey Fager-Pellessier is a spokesperson for the FBI's Anchorage office and says the drill has less to do with Alaska as a potential target for an attack than with the cold, snowy weather that can be hard to come by near the Bureau's headquarters in Washington, D.C.
This was absolutely not something that was done because of a perceived credible threat that was going to happen on our area. Absolutely not. They really wanted to do it for more of a winter environment.
A specialized team of trainers from the Critical Incident Response Group based in D.C. helped local agents with logistics training. National security protocols dictate that when a weapon of mass destruction is located, the FBI takes lead, coordinating with local agencies, which in this case involved the Defense Department, Port of Anchorage, Department of Energy, and Anchorage Police. Though Alaska is not considered a high-risk target, ports across the country have been consistently criticized for their vulnerability to attack. As of 2012, only about 4% of the 9 million containers shipped into U.S. ports were screened, according to Bloomberg News. The Port of Anchorage handled nearly 2 million tons of freight last year, constituting about 90% of all the cargo brought into Alaska. Fager-Pellessier couldn't say how much the exercise cost. Fire marshals are on the scene in Bethel investigating the Kilbuck campus fire. They're photographing the site, talking with the fire department and interviewing witnesses, trying to assess the damage and determine the cause of the fire.
We're not ruling out anything at this point, but we don't have anything to offer as far as what caused the fire. So everything you've heard so far is rumor and or speculation.
Bill Howell is chief of Bethel's fire department.
Basically, the process is reconstructing, you know, trying to find where the fire started, what might have started it. The areas of greatest damage often lead us to the area where the fire started.
The debris is still smoking, even after continuous rainfall from last night through this evening. Howell said the rain helped prevent reignition, but with a large structure, it's common for deep-seated flames to continue burning. The fire department contained the fire around 6 p.m. yesterday after approximately 14 hours of nonstop work to suppress the inferno.
In the 22 years I've been here, you know, this is a significant fire. This is one of the biggest structure fires we've ever fought.
About 20 firefighters, most of them volunteers, helped fight the flames as police monitored the perimeter and the city's Public Works Department hauled truck after truck of water to the scene. Fire crews responded to the scene around 3:45 yesterday morning. Howell says within a few hours, low visibility and extreme heat within the structure forced responders to evacuate and recalibrate.
So we made a calculated decision to start opening up the building to create fire breaks,
which meant ripping away sections of the building to isolate the burning.
We felt that it would be better to save something rather than nothing.
The Yupik Immersion School is lost. The Kuskokwim Learning Academy dorms and gymnasium are standing, but the extent of damage is unknown. The City of Bethel is working with the Department of Homeland Security to draft a disaster declaration, asking the governor to declare a state of emergency and allocate recovery resources to the city. still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering Big Bob Aiken, a legend of traditional Alaska Native games.
He was very, very focused on making sure and passing on the wisdom of the past to children of the future.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The state has a new foster care program aimed at keeping Western Alaska children in their communities. It incorporates therapeutic methods to help fix behavioral issues in the home that might be affecting both the child and parent. There's just one major hiccup. No one has signed up yet. KYUK's Lakedra Chavis reports.
Venetia Gardner, the Protective Services Manager for the Office of Children's Services Western Region, says the goal of bringing therapeutic foster care to this part of the state is simple: to keep children in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
So within the 56 villages, we would like to at least have some hub type of therapeutic foster homes, in which case the child would be able to stay closer to their culture, stay closer to their relatives, to their parents.
There's just one problem.
I do not have a yes yet. I still need the communities to come together and bring somebody forward.
Therapeutic foster care carries the basic framework of regular foster care, but it's designed to offer mental and behavioral health treatment to children who have suffered severe trauma, like abuse. The program also works to improve the behaviors of the parent. AK Child and Family is the licensing agency for the Delta. Doug White is the agency's director of community programs, and he says the name foster care and the title may be a bit misleading.
They simply need a placement out of their home for a period of time to help the family and the children address any behavioral issues that they might be having.
Therapeutic foster care parents are trained on mental health issues, solutions to handling them, and community resources available to assist the child. Success in the program is measured by its ability to keep children in their communities instead of sending them elsewhere for these types of services.
When that link is broken within the family system, it's often very difficult to get children back. We hear time and time again from families and elders that children leave for treatment and they don't come back for years.
White says the factors for becoming a successful therapeutic parent are flexibility, openness, and understanding. But there are some barriers. Part of the requirement of becoming a therapeutic foster parent is a 2-month training in Anchorage. However, the agencies are trying to find ways to have the training in a hub, like Bethel. In general, therapeutic foster care is more community-centric. Social workers conduct more house checks, families interact with healthcare professionals more, they have to attend treatment planning sessions, take the child to appointments, and complete daily reports on the child's behavior. Currently, OCS and AK Child and Family, among other agencies in the Delta, are working once a month to discuss ways to increase public awareness. They've focused on foster parents currently in the Delta, but to date, no one has committed to the program. The program has been done in smaller places, like Nome. In Alaska, there are 43 therapeutic foster parents, but officials say the biggest barrier in the Delta seems to be the time commitment to becoming one. In Bethel, I'm Lakedra Chavis.
A legend of traditional Alaska Native games has died. Big Bob Aiken, known as the world's largest Eskimo, still held records for the Indian and Eskimo stick pull competitions. He believed deeply in the original purpose of the games. In a phone conversation last July from the World Eskimo Indian Olympics, or WIO, games in Fairbanks, he said the games were meant to be friendly competition that tested strength and revealed who would be a good hunter.
Then if you knew exactly what you're capable of, you'd have a better chance of surviving in an incident that happens out in the wilderness. And I hurt myself one time, and I knew what I was capable of by these games. So we were raised to survive whatever happens. That's who we are. That's how we grew up.
Lou Friedman worked as a reporter for the Anchorage Daily News in the late 1980s and became a friend of Bob Aiken as he covered him in Fairbanks at the WIO Games. He said although Aiken didn't have his own children, he cared for all children involved in the games and was an important diplomat.
The kids would like swarm around him, and he was interacting with everybody. You know, it was sort of like, you know, we can't make a decision about anything without seeing what Big Bob thinks about it. And he was that kind of fella. You know, he just stood out with a big personality to go with his big size.
Friedman says he thinks the final year that Aiken competed in strength games was 1989, and Big Bob intended to retire with all of his gold medals and one more win.
There was a big surprise that year because a new guy came on the scene, Brian Walker from Eagle River, who was also a big guy, but nobody was as big as Big Bob at the time. And Brian beat him. And so actually, Big Bob lost at the end of his career, kind of probably completing the thought process that it was time to retire.
Bob Aiken was a lifelong Barrel resident until the last few years when he had to live in Anchorage for dialysis treatments. In recent months, he had also developed a heart problem. Friedman says he was a warm man with a great sense of humor, and even with his health trouble, he never missed the games, acting as an MC or an official, and remained a large figure both physically at 6'4" and as a champion of performing the games correctly.
But more than anything else, he had a sense of tradition and heritage and wanted that to be passed on to future generations. That was the most important thing to him. You'd have to say he was a keeper of the flame, and that was what was really integral to what his continuing involvement with WIO was through the rest of his adult life.
Big Bob Aiken was 62 years old and died in Anchorage on Tuesday.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
A recent study indicates fires in the Yukon Flat region of Alaska are releasing more carbon into the atmosphere than previously thought. As KWC's Robert Hannon reports, the study by University of Alaska Fairbanks scientists overturns old assumptions and paints a troubling portrait of future climate change.
When you set out to model an ecosystem, it's important to have data, a lot of data. That's why UAF researchers Dave McGuire and Alain Genet were excited about a study in the Yukon Flats looking at charcoal deposits in lake bed sediments. It gave them 1,200 years worth of data. Genet, McGuire, and their colleagues wanted to model fire regimes in the region and how they affected the carbon cycle. The sediment data, McGuire says, were revealing.
Fire frequency has been greater in the last few decades than it's been over the last 1,200 years.
Carbon is a key ingredient in global climate change. In nature, plants take up carbon dioxide and store it. Some of it is respired back to the atmosphere, but much of it finds its way into soils. In the Arctic and subarctic, that carbon is often locked up for longer periods because of permafrost. Fires moving across the landscape can release a lot of carbon. And researchers assumed released carbon spurred more plant growth, balancing the books. That might have to be revised now. By modeling the effect of long-term fire history on the ecosystem, Genet says it looks like more carbon is being released than captured.
The way we have pinned up the model before leads to an underestimation of the carbon source in interior Alaska, or at least in regions that are exposed to fire regime.
Janaya McGuire's study just looks at the Yukon Flats, but if the same conditions occur in similar Arctic and subarctic boreal forests, where roughly one-third of the Earth's terrestrial carbon is stored, the implications to climate change could be dire. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
A subsistence harvest of the emperor goose, which had been proposed for the spring of 2016, is being put off for another year, KDLG's Hannah Colton reports.
The emperor goose is a medium-sized bird with a white head and neck, black throat, and bluish-gray body. Also called beach geese, emperors nest along the YK Delta coast and winter in the Aleutians, Alaska Peninsula, and Kodiak Island. After hitting a low of 42,000 in 1986, emperor goose numbers have steadily climbed. The most recent count put the goose population above 80,000, the threshold set by the Pacific Flyway Management Council to allow some limited hunting. So the Alaska Migratory Bird Co-Management Council, or AMBCC, has been working to establish an emperor goose season in 2016. An overall limit was set at 3,500 birds. But the council is having a hard time deciding how to allocate those birds between the regions that see emperor geese. Gayla Hossett is the Bristol Bay representative to the AMBCC. She gave an update at a recent Subsistence Regional Advisory Council meeting in Dillingham.
So 3,500 would have to be divided amongst four different regions. That would be Kodiak, Aleutian, Pribilofs, Bristol Bay, YK Delta, and the Norton Sound area. Bristol Bay would have got like 500 emperor geese. And then we were sent the homework to bring back to our regional councils as to how are we going to divvy up the 500 birds within Bristol Bay.
The regional councils each met this fall to come up with their own allocation strategies, whether it be household allocations, individual harvest tags, or some other system. Bristol Bay's council, the YKC, decided they wanted to have local hunters lists. Hossett says each regional representative brought their plan to the AMBCC's fall meeting in Fairbanks.
Of course, every region decided on something different.
In the end, the Native Caucus of the AMBCC decided it needed more time to come to a consensus on how the geese should be managed.
We want it to be true co-management. We want the state, the feds, and the Native Caucus to be present and revise that plan. So we chose to not to harvest for 2016. Revise the plan, and we'll have a harvest for 2017.
Also at issue was the time frame of the proposed harvest. It would have been open from April through August. Courtney Cardi, Bristol Bay's alternate representative to the AMBCC, says that spring and summer harvest wouldn't be fair to hunters in regions where the geese are found in the fall.
On the Alaska Peninsula and in the Aleutian Islands, they're there in the fall and the early spring. They would be inaccessible for their hunters to harvest those birds based on that time frame, and that was another big arguing point as to why we would wait.
The AMBCC's spring statewide meeting will be held in Bethel. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Ketchikan's animal shelter has gotten some relief in recent weeks after rescuing more than 40 animals from a North Tongass Highway home in early October. Local animal rescue groups took some of the pets from the maxed-out Ketchikan Gateway Borough-run shelter. Other animals were adopted within the community, and it was announced this week that the shelter in Sitka has raised money to fly the remaining dogs to that community. KRBD's Layla Carey visited the Ketchikan shelter and has the story.
Eddie Blackwood runs the Ketchikan Borough's Animal Protection Department. He says that of the approximately 40 animals that were rescued on October 9th, the Ketchikan Humane Society took four dogs. Bark Alaska Rescue took two dogs, a chicken and a rooster. Southeast Organization for Animals is taking two dogs, and Sitka is taking all the remaining canines. Blackwood says Sitka shelter director Ken Buxton told him there was immense interest in the case within that community.
And he called and said, I have people knocking on my door wanting these animals, and they're even raising money for the flight in Sitka. As of 2 weeks ago, he'd raised $600 for the airfare, so he thought he could probably raise enough to cover the whole entire airfare.
And he did. Buxton says he used his Critter Corner column in the Sitka Sentinel to write about the Ketchikan project and started collecting donations.
We've raised close to $1,400, so going to charter a flight with Scott Harris over here, and We're going to pick up 11 of those dogs, and one of them is already spoken for.
Buxton says the others will either go into foster homes or the Sitka shelter, but he's got a list of people interested in adopting as soon as the dogs are ready. He praised the Ketchikan shelter and rescue groups for their hard work, and not only for the pets rescued from the North End home.
I think sometimes the media might throw the word hero around too much, but those guys are heroes. The stuff they're doing, just going over top with caring for these animals, and these dogs in particular.
The dogs rescued from the home all were small dogs, likely terrier mixes. Most crowd up to the front of their large cages, wagging furiously, eager to sniff an outstretched hand and offer a friendly lick. Blackwood says some of the dogs have been adopted locally and just need to be spayed or neutered before they head to their new homes.
So we got Prince, Chewy, Stella, Bella, and Skittles that are going for surgery on Thursday.
And they've all been adopted?
They've all been adopted, yeah.
When the Ketchikan shelter first took in all the animals from the North End home, resources at the shelter were stretched thin. Blackwood says the community really stepped up with lots of donations of food and supplies, as well as volunteers coming in to help care for and comfort the animals.
I think they were shocked at the situation. It was a very sad situation. And it's very sad that the lady passed away, but I'm just glad we were able to help the animals that she had. That's a good thing.
The elderly woman lived in a North Tongass home. Alaska State Troopers had been called there and found her in need of medical help. She later died. While at the home, troopers noted the large number of animals and contacted the borough's Animal Protection Department. The floor of the home was covered in feces, and three animals were found dead. Animal Protection removed 31 dogs, 6 cats, and 3 chickens, but one of the chickens later was euthanized because of an injury. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
Finally tonight, we have a correction. In last evening's story detailing the Senate vote approving TransCanada's buyout, we incorrectly stated the vote count. It was 16-3. We also mistakenly identified Senator Pete Kelly as an Anchorage Republican. Senator Kelly is from Fairbanks. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholz and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Anna Rose MacArthur and Lakeed Rashavis in Bethel, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, and Layla Carey in Ketchikan. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer and web editor is Monica Goki. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
And by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
And by
the University of Alaska Southeast, with schools of arts and sciences, management, education, and career education in Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka. UAS, a learning community on campus and online. More at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.